Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to introduce to you, if you haven't met him before, Shoryu Bradley. He and I have been practicing together since the early part of this century.
That's right.
Doesn't that sound grand?
Yes.
We practiced together at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, the Zen Monastery in California. And you're now, is it in the Ozarks?
Yes.
He's now tucked away in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas and is developing a mountain practice center there. So you might say a few things about it, do you think?
Yeah, that's the talk will be about that primarily, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to be here. I love being in Austin. I grew up in College Station, which, you know, you all probably know College Station quite well. But I went to school here at UT as a graduate student, and I lived here for 11 years. So I love Austin. I have a lot of friends here, a lot of memories, and fond memories of beginning to practice here with many of you I see out in the audience. So thank you for having me here. So as Kosho said, I'm developing a monastery in northwestern Arkansas. I appreciate the environmental group here was interested in the practice there, because one of the things that I wanted to have in place in this practice center, since I've been dreaming about it for many years now, would be that it would be environmentally friendly, a sustainable way of life. So I'm going to talk about that primarily, just what I think the importance of an environmentally sensitive approach to practice is, and then how I think this relates to what's happening in Arkansas, just to give you a few stories maybe and things that happened to me there. So the place is about 50 miles west of, 50 miles east of Fayetteville, if you're familiar with Arkansas at all. It's in the Ozark Mountains, near the Buffalo River. So the reason that I wanted to develop a place, a new place for practice, was that I wanted to have people have the opportunity to practice in my teacher's style of practice, which is sort of an unusual practice in Soto Zen. We, during Sesshin, we just focus on Zazen primarily. We don't do any ceremony. So the Sesshins are 5 days long, and we're sitting for 14 hours a day, basically, sitting and walking, focusing on Zazen. So I wanted to have a place that would focus on that sesshin, do that sesshin every month. And my teacher and his teacher's teacher practiced this way at a temple called Antaiji in Japan. And so, yes, that's where the practice was developed. And so I wanted this place to be a place that people could come for any length of time, one day, a month, a week, for Sesshin, to really focus on Zazen, to be clear that that's the central part of your life. So one of the ways that I might be able to explain to you why I think it's important for us to include environmental sensitivity in our practice is by explaining the name, or where I was inspired to get the name for the monastery. The name of the monastery is Gyobutsuji. It's a Japanese word. So I kept it in Japanese because I think it's harder to translate into English the exact meaning. The inspiration for the word comes from a chapter of the Shobo Genzo. It was written by the great Zen master Eihei Dogen. And the chapter was called Gyobutsu Igi. And this is a Buddhist term in Japanese that refers to the conduct and practice of a Buddha, the deportment of a Buddha. So it's something that we emulate as Buddhists, something that we endeavor to emulate. So I'll read to you just a little piece, a few pieces from Gyobutsu Iki. My teacher translates that as the dignified practice or the dignified conduct of practice Buddha. And my teacher is Shohaku Okumura. He was here last winter, I think, or early spring. So from Gyobutsu Iki, all Buddhas without exception fully practice dignified conduct. This practice is practice Buddha. Sharing one corner of the Buddha's dignified conduct is done together with the entire universe, the great earth, and the entire coming and going of life and death. This is nothing other than the dignified conduct of the oneness of practice and Buddha. So Buddha here, of course, is not referring to a historical being, but the whole works, we might say, or the Buddha. Dogen called it Zenki in another chapter, the total dynamic function, the whole works. Or we could say just life in general, life blossoming in general. So Dogen was unusual in that he actually named a Buddha practice. So we manifest practice Buddha when we sit Zazen, or when we manifest Zazen in any activity that we do. So this is the spirit behind Gyobutsu-ji, the temple or the monastery of practice Buddha. We hope that our practice manifests this kind of oneness and individuality beyond thinking that goes beyond our individual desires, attainments, and ideas. So the practice, we hope our practice of Zazen is supported, or we are supporting, well, it's a fact, I should say, that, or a teaching, that our practice is supported by all beings. And we hope that we're supporting our endeavor, our intention is to support all beings through our practice rather than a way to sort of develop our own spiritual path. It's more through developing ourselves we allow all existence to manifest in harmony with it. In another place, Dogen wrote about this time of Zazen in his essay called Bendo Wa. He said, at this time of Zazen, earth, grasses and trees, fences and walls, tiles and pebbles, all things in the Dharma realm in the 10 directions carry out Buddha work. Therefore, everyone receives the benefit of wind and water movement caused by this functioning, and all are imperceptibly helped by the wondrous and incomprehensible influence of Buddha to actualize the enlightenment at hand. So again, I think the Buddha he's talking about here is practice Buddha, the universal Buddha. So we're supported and we're supporting all beings when we sit Zazen. So in some ways this sounds a little bit abstract or mystical or somehow beyond the realm of human experience that we have every day. But I got to thinking about this, and there's so many different levels of this teaching, but and one of them is very concrete, I think. For me, for example, trees are such a deep part of the practice there at Gyobutsu-ji. We have many beautiful trees. My favorites, my preferences are for the dogwoods and the redwoods that bloom in the spring. They're so beautiful. But so many oaks, pecan trees, lots of different kinds of trees there. So the trees do many things, but one of the things that they do for me is that they offer heat for the wood-burning stove. It's my only source of heat there. So it's amazing to me. I try to remember when I'm gathering firewood that I'm going out on the property. I'm simply picking up firewood that's offered freely. I don't have to cut anything down because there are lots of trees that are already fallen. And you know, I'm cutting that up, storing it, and using it for my heat. And each one of those trees has such a vast history behind it. They've supported many sentient beings, many squirrels, many birds, many insects. They've helped to make the air suitable so that we can breathe it. They've helped to cultivate the soil so that other beings and plants can live there. And then in one of these final stages of its so-called existence, it's ending up in my stove so that I can receive heat and I can practice. I can nurture this body and mind so that I can sit and practice. So in this way, you know, Zazen really is supported by trees, grasses, and pebbles in these types of ways, conventional ways that we can actually see. Just talking a little bit about the environmental issues, the problems that we're faced with now. There, of course, it's a vast subject, but I'll just make sort of a blanket statement here about my opinion on one thing, and that is the source of these problems are all a so-called spiritual problem, for lack of a better word. I think it's really rooted in a perspective that things around us are placed there for us to use at our disposal. That there's this kind of separation. I'm the center of the universe is the basic attitude. And whatever means I need to use to serve that being in the center is okay, without thinking as much about the cause and conditions that have come to produce the situation we're in, or that will produce other situations that will happen as a result. Am I talking loud enough for you guys back there? Okay. Thank you. So this is a basic problem, I think, is seeing things, people, our environment, all things in our life as something for our use, as objects of our own desire. So this is part of the medicine. Our Zazen is the medicine for that attitude. And in our Zazen, we come to know, knowing isn't exactly the right word, but we come to meet our lives more intimately so that we understand in a deep way that everything we encounter is our own life. There's nothing we encounter that is separate from us. And we need to care for the things that we encounter as we care for our own body and mind. So another scripture, it's an interesting thing actually. You can't really go back and search the Buddhist canon, of course, for environmental scriptures, because this is a new problem, a relatively new problem. But the attitude, I think, is there. And we don't really have to call ourselves environmentalists or Zen environmentalists, I think we simply need to practice wholeheartedly and try to pay attention, be awake, and care for our lives. So another writing of Dogen, Ehe Dogen, was an important writing of his. It's called the Tenzo Kyokun, which was instructions for a Zen cook. And it's a really wonderful text in that he uses cooking. Well, it's on one level, it's instructions for a cook. On many deeper levels, though, he's giving instructions on how to make Zazen the center of your life, how to manifest Zazen through every activity that you do. So just a couple of passages from there briefly from the Tenzo Kyokun. Zen master Bao Ming Rian Yong said, "Guard the temple properties as if they were your very eyes. Respect the temple food as if it were for the emperor." Another passage said, an ancient said, "When steaming rice, regard the pot as your own head. When washing rice, know that the water is your own life. So Dogen talked about making an offering to the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, as the highest activity that we should be joyful and grateful for, to make this offering, this rare thing, to make an offering to the three treasures through cooking. Uchama Roshi, by the way, wrote a book called How to Cook Your Life, which was based a commentary on the Tenzo Kyokun. So this is what Dogen's talking about, is how to cook your life, meet your life. But the three treasures, I think he talks about the three treasures from many different perspectives. In another writing, he talks about the absolute three treasures, the manifesting and the maintaining three treasures. So I think he moves from these different perspectives. And from an absolute view, there's really not to say from much to say from an absolute view, of course, but from that view, everything is our Sangha. The Sangha is actually the entire universe, and the whole earth and the whole sky is our Sangha that we need to care for, I think. It's interesting, I'm living there mostly alone in Arkansas now, and I do a short service, and there's a part, you know, after Zazen I do this little service, and there's a part of the service that says, may peace and tranquility pervade this Sangha. And I used to feel kind of silly about that, because I was the only guy in the woods sitting there, you know, chanting and dedicating this to our Sangha. But then I realized the longer I've been there, that the more extensive and the deeper and richer that my Sangha is. I have so much wildlife that I'm in touch with there, many hawks. I have red-shouldered hawks there, always usually calling during morning service. Foxes, they bark at me sometimes. I've seen a bear, big black bear, turkeys, birds. I have a bat living over the overhang on the deck. I see him every day, go out usually for food and come back. So my Sangha really is there, and I feel like they're really supporting me, and I hope that there's some way, it's my responsibility actually, that I support them and care for them. So back to this saying, an ancient said, when steaming rice, regard the pot as your own head. When washing rice, know that the water is your own life. The pot, it's an ancient Zen Japanese attitude that our tools are extensions of our own life. You know, you care for your tools as if you care for your own body. You take care of the bell ringer and the bell here very respectfully, because they help you and support you in practice. You care for the pot that you cook your food with as if it were part of your own body. You don't gather things around you and throw them away into the landfill after they lose their sheen so you can get the latest, you know, update or whatever. You care for things and respect them as if they're your own life. And I think the temple properties from this absolute perspective include rivers, oceans, trees, and the earth around us. Those are the temple that we practice in and we breathe. That we live in. We must care for these things. They support us and enable us to practice. The water which cooks our rice literally becomes our body when we eat the rice. So you drink a glass of water, it becomes you. It's very clear. Water, clean water, is becoming more and more rare around the world. At Gyobutsuji, I have a special appreciation for water there too, because all of the water is harvested from a rainwater collection system. There's a big kind of roof structure built that it's very simple, collects the water and sends it into a cistern, and then there's gravity-fed plumbing that comes to the house. And, you know, it's a bit higher, the cistern is a bit higher, so it comes down to the house with gravity-fed plumbing. So we're experiencing a serious drought up in Arkansas right now. It's similar to what was happening here last year, I think, and everything is very thirsty. So the cistern is, it hasn't been in danger of running out so far since I've been there, but when I've had some guests and there's several people there, it's gotten a bit low, and I knew that if we didn't have rain for months or had a really dry summer, that it would run out. So this is when it does rain there, I, of course, am very happy for the trees that are drying up and all the other beings, but I've also realized, well, the cistern is filling up. Thank goodness. You know, I have to limit my showers. I have to limit the washing and stuff up there. So I have this connection with the water source, and it's one of the ways that this kind of environment, I think, is a teacher for me, for us. And it's one of the reasons that I wanted to locate the monastery in a more natural setting and to have a more natural, well, simple way of life, I guess, is that we're so embedded, of course, in the modern conveniences that it's harder for us to see cause and effect in our life. It's harder for us to see the causes that are in place that produce the things that we use, for example. You know, where do they come from? Who made them? What process did they go through to make them? And also, what happens to those products when we dispose of them? We don't really know. We take it out to the curb, and we're not, you know, we have faith, we hope that it's taken care of, but we're not directly connected with that process. And in so many other ways of life, the way, you know, we get water out of the faucet, and we don't see what happens to it before it comes to us. We just turn a knob and it's there. So we don't see what happens when we pour paint into the drain, for example. Actually, just while I'm saying that, one time, you know, this was many years ago or several years ago when I was in Bloomington, and I was working for some people, doing odd jobs for them, and one of the things that I did for them, or they asked me to do one time, was to clean the siding of their house with some cleaning solution that I didn't feel that good about. I wouldn't have used it. It was just some stuff that, you know, I wouldn't have used, but I was like, well, should I say something? Is my place to say something to them, or I don't want to be self-righteous or whatever, and I just used the stuff, and I didn't know what to do with it after I was finished with it, was the thing, too, because I was afraid they were just going to tell me to throw it down the drain or something, and so I thought, well, maybe if I just put a little bit, just put it on the ground, you know, and let it filter out, that not many beings will come in contact with it because the earth will filter it out. So I poured a little bit out on the ground, and to my horror, earthworms started coming out of the ground, sort of writhing, you know. It was a very direct experience that these things are harmful to other beings, and if we don't care for them in the right way, they have a really harsh effect on our environment. So that was a teaching that will always stay with me, I think. I wanted to read one other passage from the Dhammapada, which is one of my favorite scriptures. It's a very early Buddhist text. The scholars think that the actual voice of the historical Buddha could be recorded in the Dhammapada. It's very old. So this is just a section from the chapter called Flowers. It says, "Knowing this body is like foam, fully awake to its mirage-like nature. Cutting off Mara's flowers, one goes unseen by the king of death. Death sweeps away the person obsessed with gathering flowers, as a great flood sweeps away a sleeping village. The person obsessed with gathering flowers is under the sway of death. But as a bee gathers nectar and moves on without harming the flower, its color, or its fragrance, just so should a sage walk through a village." So there's so much in this that, you know, you could write a book about it, but one of the things I think the Buddha's talking about here is, of course, the gathering of flowers is gathering scents appetites or being addicted to sense appetites or using things in our environment as objects of our desire. So that's the cause of death, the cause of birth and death, of samsara, of suffering. And the suffering for ourselves and the suffering for other beings is this using things in our environment as objects of our desire. But the bee gathering nectar, being compared to a Buddhist monk, is a beautiful image, I think. And the Buddha was admonishing his disciples to go through the villages in the early period of Buddhism, I think, without taxing the lay people that made the offerings to them. So Buddhist monks in the early days would walk through the village holding their bowl and ask for offerings from the lay people. And they were actually expected to give a teaching, to offer something back in return. It was just what was happening. So in this way, the bee gathering flower not only doesn't harm, but it offers something back through its practice. It pollinates the flower so that the flower can grow seeds, and the flower offers itself to the bee so the bee can make honey. And they don't have to think it out or, you know, try. They just wholeheartedly do what they're meant to do. And so I think this is what he was talking about with his monks. But, of course, today we don't have to limit that to monks, and the entire earth and sky is our village. You know, can we walk through making our offering and doing no harm? So, a little story about Ikkyu Sen. Was a famous Zen master, Rinzai master. This story you may know. A student asked him one time, "What is the basis of the Dharma? What is the essence of the teaching?" And he simply took his brush and brushed attention. And this monk didn't understand. He said, "What? What?" So again, Ikkyu just brushed attention, attention. The monk said, "That, how profound is that? That's, you're brushing these words." Ikkyu just again brushed attention, attention, attention. That was the essence of the Dharma for him. And it's really true. As I was saying earlier, one of the reasons that I wanted to locate the monastery in this kind of setting is that it is easier to pay attention to the effects that we have on the environment around us and on our own practice, our own issues with the other beings and things that we meet in the environment too, when life is a little bit simpler, I believe. So this kind of immediacy with the things that we encounter is important. 99.9%, I think, of the things that are most important to us in life are freely given, are gifts that are given to us. The air that we breathe, the heat that we receive, the water that we receive. These are all gifts, but these are things that we tend to take for granted the most. For example, electricity, we don't think about it so much. Often we don't. We're trying. I know we're all trying, and we're educating ourselves, many of us. But it's easy to just flip the switch and not think of the karma involved there, to pay attention of what's happening when you actually do that. So Gyobutsuji, those... I get all the electricity from a solar harvesting system. So when I'm working on my computer, when I think about it, it's amazing. I'm just working off of the energy of the sun, you know, directly. But part of the parameters around that, or part of the effect of that, is that on those precious days when it is rainy or cloudy, I have to be more careful about what I'm using with the electricity. In fact, to tell you the truth, the system is a bit underpowered, so I don't have enough power really to run. It's mainly the small refrigerator there. There's a small refrigerator that comes on and off, and you know, you can see the energy just go way down when it comes off. So it needs to be upgraded. But so on a cloudy day, I have to make this decision. Well, do I keep the food cold, or do I keep the batteries that are storing the energy healthy? Because if you let them get down to a certain extent, it's harming them, and the life of the batteries is decreased. And you know, the more batteries you have to use, the worse it is for the environment and so forth. Or, you know, producing the batteries has an effect too. And so so it's an issue. It's a way I have to pay attention. So I think I'm just about finished, but I had another couple of stories just to tell you about paying attention there. One was I have this deck that's in front of the one building that's there that I spend a lot of time on. I'm actually working on a railing for it right now, and I go out there to do various things, and you can actually see the deck when you're inside. So there was a skink living on the deck, or a skink. I don't know if you know what a skink is, but it's a lizard that looks like a snake with legs, basically. And the one that was living here was particularly beautiful, and it's bigger than the ones that I've seen before. It's about this big with its tail, and it had this beautiful fluorescent part on its back with stripes and blue markings. And then it had this beautiful ruby red throat underneath it that was fluorescent kind of color. And he was living underneath the door jamb of the bathroom. The bathroom's on the outside. And so I would see him coming out of that crack almost, several times a day. First thing he would do would be go out and sun himself on the warm deck, because he needed to warm up. And then I'd see him scurrying around, looking through the cracks in the deck, in the plank for insects, I guess. We have a lot of these big black carpenter ants. I think he was probably feasting on those. And I realized that probably part of the reason that I don't have more insects inside the house is because of the lizards around the place. So I really felt like the skink was part of the sangha, doing his job, you know, making his making his effort, his contribution. And because I really was I was a bit worried about how to deal with insects inside, because I didn't want to use chemicals and stuff, but it hasn't been a problem yet. So one day I finally got around to the project that I had been wanting to get around for a while, and that was cleaning out the storage area right next to the bathroom. I'd just been putting stuff in there while I was moving in, and not just sort of haphazardly. So part of that process involved taking everything out of the closet and setting it on the deck so I could organize it and put it back in, throw stuff into the recycling or whatever. And then one of the things I had was a pan that I used to change the oil in my car with, and it had a little bit of oil in it still. I hadn't gotten around to putting it in a bag or anything to protect it. So I put that actually out on the grass because I didn't want to step on it and make a mess. I knew I was liable to do that. And so I was cleaning up the stuff, and a couple hours later I came to the pan and was heartbroken to see the skink in the pan. It had died in the pan. It was probably really warm, you know. He thought it was black, so it was really hot in there. He probably went in there to heat up, but he was gone. And there's not another skink living there yet. I keep hoping one will come back, but they don't. So this is a direct effect of not paying attention to what needed to be taken care of in that situation for me. You know, it's a really hard lesson for me to learn, but it was a lot harder on the skink. You know, he paid the he paid a big price for my negligence. One other thing, there's actually a dogwood tree that is right next to our deck, That's a beautiful member of the Sangha, I think. It offers these wonderful white flowers in the spring, these big white, you know, dogwood flowers. And so I got kind of disturbed. A few weeks ago, it started dropping its leaves because of the drought. And I think dogwoods are one of the first things that drop their leaves out there. So I don't have enough water in the cistern to water it, of course. So there's a pond on the property that that I started using to water it. I was going out to the pond and putting water in this big bucket-like thing and putting it in a wheelbarrow and hauling it over, and then I'd siphon it out slowly onto the tree so it could absorb it. And so when I was happy when I first started doing it that I figured out how to do it, but then I noticed that there were all of these beings in the pond water. There were all these sentient beings losing their life as I was watering the tree, you know. So, and to most of us, or to many of us in our kind of everyday mind, we think, well, you know, some water bugs and leeches and, you know, little animals are probably worth saving, you know, a dogwood tree, a beautiful dogwood tree for. But I'm a Buddhist monk, and we have a precept against killing. All of us are, you know, Buddhists, and or many of us here are. And we need to look at these kinds of things, because I think our Zazen, the great teaching of our Zazen, is that we're always willing to see something from a different perspective. And we can't think that we know that because we know that it's okay that certain beings can be sacrificed for a higher good. And we've seen this kind of thinking through our history in our society many times, when people are very sure that some god or some principle has given them the right to, you know, do something not so good in the cause of the higher good. And sometimes we do. I'm a human being, and I have a human perspective. And to human beings, you know, dogwood trees are usually more important than a water strider. So I can't step out of my idea of being a human being, but I have to understand that the water strider and those other beings have a perspective different than mine, and my perspective is not the center of the universe. So anyway, it's sort of one of the things we have to do, I think, when we do these kinds of things, which are sometimes necessary, is to do it with a heavy, repentant heart. And that enables us to see if there's some other way to do it better, I think. And actually, I started noticing that if I kind of waited so that the last bit of water wouldn't be put out onto the ground, that a lot of the beings would still be there, and I could go dump them back into the pond and get some more water. So there was a way to save some of them, you know. But I think it's an important thing, is to make sure that we're always trying to see things from a broader perspective, and you know, we're willing to be wrong. You know, Suzuki Roshi, of course, said famously that in the expert's mind there are few possibilities, but in the beginner's mind there are limitless possibilities. And I think that's what he meant, is that we have to be able to see things from a broader perspective when possible. So I think that's all I have to say for my talk. I thank you very much for having me here. I appreciate especially the members of the environmental group here inviting me and taking me out to dinner. And in case you guys didn't know, there's an environmental group here that I guess you can go to Rob or Ann, and they'll tell you, Jordan, they'll tell you when they meet and stuff. So, and I don't think we're supposed to ended a quarter after, right? So I guess we're finished. Yeah. Thank you very much.